The topics and opinions expressed in the following show are solely those of the hosts and their guests and not those of W4CY Radio, its employees, or affiliates. We make no recommendations or endorsements for radio show programs, services, or products mentioned on air or on our web. No liability, explicit or implied, shall be extended to W4CY Radio or its employees or affiliates. Any questions or comments should be directed to those show hosts. Thank you for choosing W4CY Radio.
Your hosts, Melanie Young and David Ransom, your insatiably curious culinary couple. Each week, we bring you the dynamic thought leaders who work front and center and behind the scenes in wine, food, spirits, hospitality, and publishing. And it's always an engaging conversation here at our table, right, David?
It sure is, Melanie.
And this is kind of an appropriate show. Today, we're coming live from W4CY Radio on November 18th, 2020, and we just finished a presidential election, and we're heading into the Thanksgiving holidays, and we have been roaming around the country, spending time in New York State and Virginia, immersing ourselves in Virginia wines. If you follow us, you know that, because we've had a number of Virginia vintners on our show, as well as New York State vintners. So we're very excited. We have two wine-focused guests this week. The first is the author of a fascinating new book called Wine and the White House, A History. I'd say it's a great read and a coffee table book. It will definitely have people talking if they see it on your table. And we're really excited to have Frederick J. Ryan Jr. join us. He will be our first guest. I'll get into his history in a little bit. And then the second, there is a tie-in because Giovanni Mazzai of Castello di Fontrotoli in Tuscany is a 26th generation family member of Philip Mazzai, who actually is featured in Wine in the White House, A History, because of his Thomas Jefferson
connection.
Right.
So it'll be a great tie-in. And we've been poring over this book, Wine in the White House, A History by Fred Ryan, for weeks now, and it's just been a fascinating read and really delves into the history and the people involved and the wine served and the menus written, everything about the White House. It's just a great book.
So a little bit about Frederick J. Ryan Jr. He also is the publisher and CEO of the Washington Post, which is one of my favorite newspapers. It was one of my dreams, was to work at the Washington Post post-Watergate. And he's been an aficionado of both wine and White House history for most of his life. He grew up in Italy and California, developed an early interest in wine, studied winemaking and history, and now participates in a joint venture, a winemaking venture in Napa Valley. I think it's called Ryan Vineyards. We'll talk to him about it. But his fascination with wine parallels his lifelong interest in the American presidency. He served in a senior staff position in the Ronald Reagan White House and is Reagan's post-presidential chief of staff. Ryan currently serves as the chair of the board of directors of the White House Historical Association, of the board of trustees of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation, and of the wine committee of the Metropolitan Club of Washington, D.C. So we've got someone who's highly credentialed in every aspect and inner circle, and he's going to share some amazing anecdotes with us.
He's not just a Washington insider, but he's a wine insider as well.
Yes.
So Frederick Ryan, welcome to the show.
Oh, well, thank you, David and Melanie. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, we've been fascinated by your book. When I said we haven't been able to put it down, we're absolutely not able to put it down. It's really just wonderful to read. But I want to talk to you first about how you got into wine, because in your book, you talk about your first experience with wine, and it's a hysterical little episode in you getting into wine. So why don't you start us off with that and then tell us where it went from there?
Well, I grew up in California, where at a time when the California wine business was kind of on the rise. So we paid attention to wine out there. But I think the experience you're mentioning was it kind of forced me to try to learn more about wine. I was in college and I was trying to impress a date. So I made a reservation at a fancy restaurant in Hollywood. We sat down. I ordered the prime rib for both of us. And then they brought the wine list. And I looked at it and I couldn't even pronounce, let alone understand what the wines were. And I went down the list. I was getting embarrassed. So I found the one with the shortest name, which is Chateau d'Arche. And I looked at it. I said, well, I can say that. So I said, we'll have a bottle of Chateau d'Arche. And the guy said, well, I would recommend something else. And I said, no, that's what I have. I always have it with prime rib. Every time I have prime rib, that's the wine I have. And he said, okay, and he rolled his eyes and he walked away. Our prime rib came, and then the sommelier came back with a bottle, and it was a bottle, as I know you're aware, of sweet white Sauternes wine that is perfect for a dessert or perfect with cheese, but the last thing in the world you would have with prime rib. So after the humiliation of that date, which there was no second date, I decided I better try to learn something about wine.
That's a great story. It's really one of our favorite. Oh my! And you know, a lot of young people have that experience. Flash forward, you've had a very interesting career, both in the inner circle of the White House and also at one of the most esteemed newspapers in the country. The documents our government very well as national affairs. What led you to? You know, we were actually interested to find out there is a wine director at the White House. He's been there a very long time. What led you to research this book, and what did you discover in doing it? Because it's exhaustive. There's so much detail.
Well, it started off because there have been a number of books, of course, about presidents, and then several about different aspects of the White House, the furniture in the White House, or the art in the White House, or the architecture, or the music. But there had never been anything written about the wine in the White House. And I had an interest both in wine and in the presidency in terms of studying it. And I thought, what an opportunity to write a book about the intersection of two interests. So I started getting into it, and it was originally intended to be somewhat shorter, but I kept finding more and more information that I thought would be interesting. I understood, undercovered a lot of surprises. And it became quite extensive, and I figured, well, if I'm this far in, I might as well try to make it the definitive piece on wine in the White House. So, as you mentioned, it's 450 pages and weighs 5.5 pounds if you want to work on those biceps while you're reading it. But it is quite comprehensive. And the other thing I would say is I wanted it to be fun. I didn't want it to be just a history book. So as you will notice, on every page or two, there's a very short quote or a toast or something humorous that a president or someone familiar with wine has said over the years. And those make great kind of quotes for people to use in speeches or just things to entertain themselves.
And it's not just diplomats and presidents that you quote. You actually quote James Bond or Sean Connery as James Bond in the book and one of his great lines. But, you know, I have a question for you because obviously diplomacy is central to the White House. Why do you think wine has been so central to diplomacy and as it serves the White House?
Well, it's wine has really been central to the human experience as far back as history goes. The ancient Greeks would pay tribute to their heroes and gods with raising a glass of wine. And in ancient Rome, it was common at large banquets for a large vessel of wine to be passed around the room, and people would take a taste of it, and they would hand it to the person next to them and wish them good health as they handed it to them. And in fact, in Rome, I found that the Roman Senate passed a law that at every banquet, there had to be a toast to the health of Caesar Augustus. And it's interesting, this is where the word toast actually originated. As I got into this, I found that it really got kind of, there's a whole chapter, as you'll see, on toasting. Mm-hmm. And toast, the term originated because back in this time, in ancient Rome, they would pass around this huge vessel with not necessarily the best wine in it, and they would take a piece of burnt bread or toast, and they would drop it in the vessel to absorb the impurities. And that's where the words, when people talk about toast today, that's where it originated. Then if you kind of fast forward, I discovered that later in the Scottish Highlands around the 11th century, warriors would come back from battle and they would drink from the skulls of their fallen enemies. Mm. And that's today when you hear somebody raise a glass and they say skull, well, that's what it goes back to. But it became more civilized in recent times. In the United States, in fact, after the Revolutionary War, it was a tradition to have 13 toasts at every official banquet in honor of the 13 original colonies. And that, as time went on, that was shortened into more recently to a single toast. And those were the protocol evolved where it's 2 to 3 minutes instead of at one time the visiting leaders and the president would give huge foreign policy speeches and bore everybody. But it's now 2 to 3 minutes, and it's done at the beginning of the meal, which is a Jimmy Carter legacy. Jimmy Carter had the president of Mexico at the White House, and he got anxious, and he stood up before the wine had even been poured with his water glass, and he made a toast. And then he sat back down, and he realized the wine hadn't been poured yet, so He had them pour wine in his glass, and he stood up and he made the toast again. And what he found, though, was that it took the pressure off. He didn't have to spend the whole evening worrying about his toast. So every president since then has followed that, since Jimmy Carter. But it's become just, as you asked, David, it's become central to all diplomatic events, both the act of the toast, the selection of a wine, the White House showcasing great American wines.
Well, they didn't always showcase great American wines. There was a time when European wines were spotlighted. And I think which president, I think it was Ronald Reagan, but correct me if I'm wrong, who said we should always spotlight American wines.
Ronald Reagan was very big on American wines and presenting American wines to the White House. Of course, he had been governor of California at the time that the California wine industry was coming of age. So he was very much a wine enthusiast anyway, but certainly California wines. But the original, and in doing the research for this book, as I said, I uncovered so many fascinating things. I found the first instance of California wine at the White House was in 1864. A guy who President Lincoln appointed to be the commissioner of the San Francisco port sent him a case of California wine as a gesture of thanks. Now, there's no record if he drank it or even how good it was, but that was kind of the first instance. And then we had, as time evolved after the after Prohibition, when there really were, had not been any foreign wines imported into the United States during the war, and there were very few American wines, the White House started to serve American wines to try to get the American wine industry going. But as you said, Melanie, it was actually Lyndon Johnson did a lot to promote American wines, California wines, Ronald Reagan. And then, as David mentioned earlier, the Clintons hired the first wine professional at the White House, Daniel Shanks. And his job was to select the very best wines of America to showcase at White House events.
But you know what's interesting? I had Megan Franck on my prior show, Dr. Constantine Franck, and she talked about how Franck wines were served at a dinner with Hillary Clinton and Angela Merkel, and how her aunt went and was so honored because the care in selecting wines, even though they're American wines, the selection focuses on the heritage of those wines as a point of diplomacy as well. So Angela Merkel, a wine with a Germanic heritage, even though made in America. So there's a lot of diplomacy in the selection as well, right?
You're absolutely right about that. In fact, one great example that I mentioned in the book is when Reagan was president, the Prime Minister of France, Jacques Chirac, was coming for an official White House dinner. And as you know, the White House dinners may last 3 or 4 hours, but those are weeks and months in the planning. Every detail is scrutinized, including the selection of the wine. And that was a challenge because here is the head of state of France, the dominant winemaker for so many years, coming to America. And Ronald Reagan, to his credit, pulled out, I believe, the perfect diplomatic coup. He served Opus One, a joint venture between Robert Mondavi of California and Baron Philippe de Rothschild of France, and he invited both of them to the dinner. So that was but that has been brought forward into future or more current administrations. I learned a very interesting thing about George Bush 43. He was in London. He and Mrs. Bush were in London for a state visit with the Queen of England. And they, as part of these state visits, there's a reciprocal dinner at the ambassador's residence afterwards. And I looked, I wanted to see what wines were served. And I saw that they served two wines. They served a Newton Chardonnay and a Peter Michael Cabernet. And in researching further, I discovered that Newton was an English winemaker who was living in California, making California Chardonnay, but he had the English background. And Peter Michael was Sir Peter Michael, who'd been knighted by the Queen, who owned a winery in California. So they were able to serve an American wine, but pay tribute to the heritage of their guest.
Well, you know, it's interesting how much research goes into something like that. Mm-hmm. Can you speak a little bit about how wines have been selected and acquired at the White House? Because I'm sure there's a lot of protocol and a lot of research that goes into that as well.
And a cellar as well. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's evolved quite a bit. In the book goes through each president and what their wine interests were and the wines that they selected and menus, et cetera. But in the early days, it was the country was reliant primarily on Madeira, George Washington's most frequently served wine was Madeira, and that was because Madeira was a hardy wine that could be made in the island off the coast of Spain that could endure the heat and the shaking of being in the hull of a boat going across the Atlantic. So Madeira was kind of just by necessity the wine. And then Thomas Jefferson, when he was over as our emissary in France, as you know, he traveled extensively in the wine country and documented all these different wines in France and Germany, Italy. And he then brought those, as our third president, he brought those to the White House. And he also advised other presidents, both before him and after, on wine selection. So that was kind of the introduction of the European wines. And that continued really until the 20th century. And then after with Franklin Roosevelt, after Prohibition, American wines were mandated by Mrs. Roosevelt. After Prohibition, she said, wine service at the White House is going to be limited and domestic. And I found this funny entry in the diary of the Secretary of the Interior, Harold Ickes. He said, I've just been at a dinner at the White House where they serve only domestic wines. The wines themselves weren't very good, and the champagne was undrinkable. So, but it evolved to say, you know, the Eisenhowers began to serve American wines kind of as a novelty. If it was a not so important event, they would serve an American wine. The Kennedys came in, that became a focus on everything French. And Jacqueline Kennedy was so attentive to selecting every aspect of the wine service and the food, and some of the best wines in the world. So the first growths from Bordeaux were served during the Kennedy administration. And then from then on, Johnson, Nixon went back and forth between French and American wines. And then from then, Ford served a Michigan wine. It was the only time a Michigan wine was served. I don't think there was a heavy demand, at least at that time, for it. And now it's exclusively American wines, California, but also from other states.
Well, that's true, because I was reading the book, and wines have been served from Washington State, Oregon, obviously New York as well.
Virginia.
And interesting to me, and people might not know this, but at the Clinton inauguration, they served Clinton Vineyards sparkling wine from the Hudson Valley.
Yeah.
And that was a big coup for us local guys up in the Hudson Valley, which is where my family owned a winery for a long time.
Well, I know Shannon Horton, who was on our show 2 weeks ago, we sent out a newsletter about the show, and she went on and on talking about what an honor it was to be in this book and served at the White House. It's really wonderful. You know, Prohibition, you addressed that because that was a time where, you know, it was illegal to sell alcohol. How did that affect the White House in terms of what was and wasn't served?
It was it happened under Woodrow Wilson, and the 18th Amendment was passed, and then the Volstead Act was the law that implemented the 18th Amendment, and he vetoed it. He was not in favor of it. He vetoed the bill, and then Congress overrode it. So it was during his administration that Prohibition began, and a funny anecdote I discovered. He was over in France, this is President Woodrow Wilson, and for the Versailles Treaty ending World War I. And after they signed it, the French Prime Minister came over to him and handed him a glass of wine. He said, I hope you enjoy this, because when you get home, you won't be able to have any. But he then, and when he left the White House, incidentally, the Volstead Act, it prohibited the transportation, manufacturing, or sale of wine. It didn't prohibit the drinking of wine, but it was just the manufacturing, transportation, or sale. So when he left the White House, he had to get special regulatory approval for him to move his wine cellar that he'd accumulated at the White House to his new home in Washington, D.C. But then following him, Harding did not exactly comply. Although America was dry, the White House was anything but dry. He was serving alcohol at his twice-a-week parties, and I even heard reports or found reports suggesting that wine that was being seized and alcohol that was being seized by the Justice Department was being sent over the White House, and President Harding was serving it. And then, of course, it ended under Franklin Roosevelt, where the 21st Amendment, and it hit a great line. After he signed the legislation enacting the 21st Amendment, he said, now it's time for a beer, and went on to have a drink.
That's great.
Well, and it was important then to really focus on serving American beverages, because we had to bring the industry back.
Bring the industry back, of course, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that was, you know, you had the combination of Prohibition and, as I mentioned earlier, World War II essentially eliminated wine service in America. There wasn't any produced domestically, and there wasn't any that was being shipped in. So America became essentially a cocktail nation, where cocktails were the beverage of choice. Mm-hmm. But you could see in the book where wine starts to emerge as part of a lifestyle. And I know David mentioned earlier James Bond. Well, it is part of pop culture. You were seeing wine appear in these luxury moments. And in one of the James Bond movies, Dr. No, there's a scene you may remember where James Bond grabs a bottle of champagne to defend himself against a guard. And Dr. No, who is sitting there calmly, says, "That's a Dom Perignon 55. It would be a pity to break it." And Bond sets it back down on the table. Well, John F. Kennedy was a huge fan of the Ian Fleming novels and movies. Mm-hmm. And I found that 2 months after that movie played with the Dom Perignon 55, on the White House state dinner menu was Dom Perignon 1955 champagne.
Oh, wow.
And, went further that I learned in the process of this that he was such a fan of the James Bond movies, they had a private showing for the next movie, From Russia with Love. And it was shown for him at the White House on November 20th, 1963, 2 days before he was assassinated.
Wow.
It was the last film he saw.
Oh, my goodness.
You asked about the... I'm sorry?
I'm a huge James Bond fan, so
yeah,
I can probably quote every wine comment in every movie.
I have another question. So, for our listeners, this book is incredibly detailed and goes through every president, even down to the selection of wine glasses. I was amazed at how simple Jacqueline Kennedy wanted the wine glasses to be, because some of them were really frilly. What about teetotalers in the White House? We have a teetotaler in the White House now, and our president-elect is also a teetotaler, I just learned, because I was researching what wine does Joe Biden drink, and he doesn't drink wine. So does anything change when it's a teetotaler in chief?
Not so much today, but if you go back in history, before Prohibition, there was the temperance movement, and that was just a movement that pressed politicians and others not to drink and not to serve alcohol. And President Rutherford B. Hayes, our 19th president, his wife, Lucy, was a leader of the temperance movement. And there was a dinner that was coming. It was very interesting. The son of the Russian Tsar, who was very, very important at that time, was coming for a state dinner at the White House. And the diplomats insisted that wine be served, saying that this is too important of an occasion not to have wine. So she made this one exception, allowed wine to be served at the state dinner for the Russian Tsar's son, and it was never served again. And all this glassware that you mentioned, there was an enormous collection of glassware in the White House, and she would only serve fruit juice. And that earned her the nickname Lemonade Lucy. There have been other presidents in more recent days. President Bush, 43, didn't drink, and of course President Trump and President Biden. But they know that it's such an important part of the entertaining as a president and diplomacy to have a good wine that they have teams of people, and often the first ladies, who help select the wines that are served at their state dinners.
Well, it's a fascinating account. Actually, Rutherford B. Hayes actually left a letter for James Garfield, his successor, asking him if he would carry on the temperance movement in the White House, and he did not. So,
yes.
So
there is. In fact, he wanted him to hang a portrait of Lemonade Lucy in the White House, and he refused.
You know, one of the things that interested me and I did not know was that Jimmy Carter actually made wine at his Georgia farm. And I know that President Trump owns a winery, but I didn't know that Jimmy Carter made wine.
Yes, he was before he became president, he grew grapes at his farm in Georgia. And then when he left office, he started actually making the wine, and he makes about 100 bottles a year, and they're given primarily to important charitable causes that he's associated with, and they auction them off, and it raises money for those charities.
No, I wonder what it tastes like. I'm curious. You know, there's not a lot of wine out of Georgia, although every state in the union makes wine, as we know. And,
yeah.
And do you still have your winery, Wine Cellars? Because I know it was served at the Obama White House, right?
It was I was very, very curious about winemaking, and I discovered this was kind of serendipity. I was in a wine store and I saw a wine bottle that said Ryan on it. So you see your name on something, and you just bought it, and I brought it home, and my wife and I tried it, and we thought it was fantastic. So I reached out to the winemaker, got on her list, and her name was Peggy Ryan, a very skilled winemaker in Napa Valley. And finally, we got to be friends, and we decided to do a 3-year joint venture and make wine together. I just wanted to learn what it was like to make wine and be close to it as I could. So she dealt with essentially what was on the inside of the bottle, and I dealt with what was on the outside of the bottle. But it was successful. It was served Mrs. Obama at a dinner in her honor. It was served in Buckingham Palace, so it was well received, and that was 100% to the skill of my partner Peggy Ryan.
So interesting.
It is very interesting. You know, Frederick, I want to fast forward a little bit, because our next guest on our show after you is Giovanni Mazzei from Castello di Fontarotoli in Tuscany, and his ancestor, Philip Mazzei, was instrumental in really starting the wine industry in the U.S. with Thomas Jefferson. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, when Thomas Jefferson came back from his travels in Europe and got a chance to see the Italian wine industry and the other wine regions, he decided that America should be making a wine of its own and a wine of comparable quality. So he had clippings brought back to the United States, and Philip Mazzei was a neighbor of his down in Virginia countryside, and they were going to grow a wine somewhat similar to Chianti, an Italian style, which had been his family's tradition in Tuscany. But among the things that were taking place, wars and other challenges kind of got in the way, and the wine business that Thomas Jefferson envisioned at that time, at least at Monticello, never got started. But today, within just surrounding the Monticello area, there are some fantastic wineries. Early Mountain Winery is just not too far from there, and of course, closer to Washington, D.C. Is RDV, which was served, Rutgers DeVinks Winery, which was served by the Obamas at a state dinner in the White House.
You know, we had Rutger on our show, and he said he was just absolutely blown away when Michelle Obama came to visit him at the winery. Yeah.
Yes, she made in terms of the modern first ladies, she was actively involved in the wine selections for the Obama White House. And President Obama, I think, considered himself more of a beer guy, but mm-hmm. she went out with her girlfriends to Virginia wineries and had tastings in the White House, and was very sophisticated in selecting the wine choices.
Well, here's to the first ladies who drink good wine. I'm all for that. And one day the first men, too. You know,
right.
I know Kamala Harris enjoys wine. She's been known to enjoy wine and also loves to cook. She's a passionate cook. So that should be interesting. I mean, I love the spirit of this book. And just for our listeners, the detail, the menus, the description of commemorative wines, the detail on the glassware. We had been to the Corning Museum of Glass, Frederick, earlier mm-hmm. In the fall, and was fascinated about that and how it interfaced with the whole wine industry. It's an incredible book and a great gift. We want to make sure we get this in. Where can our listeners buy this book? Is it available in the usual places, or do you have to go to a specific website?
It's available on Amazon mm-hmm. and also through the White House Historical Association. In the gift shop. And in addition to the book, by the way, we've also recreated, you mentioned glassware. We went back and we found the designs both of Abraham Lincoln, which was very ornate version of the American Eagle on the glassware that he ordered, and on Franklin Roosevelt, a more contemporary version of the presidential seal, one a Democrat, one a Republican, one from the 20th century, one from the 19th century. So we have recreated both decanters and glass sets with those actual seals on the side, and they're also available from the White House Historical Association.
And so the White House Historical Association is a very interesting, it's a nonprofit. It was envisioned by First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy to establish and support her vision to preserve and share the Executive Mansion's legacy for generations to come. The website is www.whitehousehistory.org. We are both history buffs and both used to live in Washington, D.C., Frederick. And so we really have enjoyed reading this book and diving into it more, particularly because it covers one of our biggest loves, which is wine and storytelling. And it was fun to see so many of our former guests, the Connect Table Live guests, in the book. We had a lot of interest in it, and we look forward to you know, sharing more about it on our website and to all of our listeners. So thank you for taking the time. I know you're very busy. You wear a lot of hats. I mean, you know, Washington Post. Well, a little busy for you these days.
Well, I know how busy you are, and I know how I love your show and appreciate your making time to have me on here. And I would just add that 100% of the sales of this book go to the educational purposes of the White House Historical Association, which is teaching young people about the White House. So it'll benefit a good cause.
We'll drink to that. That is a great reason to buy this book. Besides, it's just stunning. So thank you for sharing your time with us today on the Connected Table. We really, really appreciate it.
That's right. And folks, again, it's Wine and the White House, A History by Frederick J. Ryan Jr. And it's available
through the White House Historical Association or Amazon. But, you know, again, it does benefit a great cause. And the website, again, is www.whitehousehistory.org. All right, we're going to take a very short break. Our next guest is calling in from Italy, so we want to give him some time. Again, thank you for joining us. We'll be right back.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
Fun. And yes, this is a big book. I've been using it under my computer to lift up for my Zoom calls. It's a very beautiful book. But we're going to take you now to one of our favorite places in Italy, Tuscany. We recently had the very good pleasure of doing a Zoom tasting of beautiful wines with Giovanni Mazzei, whose family dates back. Yeah, hello, 26. He's the 26th generation family member. You heard a little bit about his ancestor, Philip, in our last segment. We're going to bring it back to now. Hello, Giovanni. How are you?
I'm really good. Good afternoon.
Well, we're so happy we're actually talking to you twice in 2 weeks, so this is wonderful. I want to tell our listeners that Giovanni Mazzei, his family is the owners and have had Castello di Fontarutoli in Tuscany since the 1400s. So it's one of the great estates of Tuscany. They make a lot of wine. They make some fabulous wines. They also own wineries in the west coast of Tuscany,
Maremma,
not Chianti Classico, which is where Fontarutoli is based, but also in Sicily now as well. So Giovanni, welcome to the show. And I've met you in Italy. We've had wine and dinner together, I'm a big fan of your wines, as is Melanie. So it's so nice to have you finally on our show.
Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure.
So, are you the 25th or 26th generation? I'm losing count.
No, I'm the 25th.
Okay, 25th. So you represent what is the new generation of this storied family. You know,
I'm the lucky one.
You're the lucky one. So the 1400s, give us a little, briefly, a snapshot of the family history. We touched on Philip and his amazing impact in Virginia, but give us a little some significant milestones about your storied family.
Well, the roots on the, well, we've all been involved in the wine industry, and my family at the time were artisans, were coopers. We were making barrels for wine. That's where our names come from. Mazzei, Mazza, Mazza is a hammer. And at the time, that was symbolizing our job, and the hammer was a wooden armor, symbolizing we were coopers working, artigiani buttai, you say in Italian. And we were living just near Florence, and that's the 11th century. And then we did a cover career in politics and military. And one of the most important characters of my family, among with Philip, is this gentleman called Serlapo Mazzei. Serlapo was he had important role in the Republic of Florence, covering, was ambassador in Venice. And he was a notary for the Republic of Florence and a famous and very good wine producer and wine trader. And thanks for one of his documents, we know that Chianti existed as a wine already in the 14th century. And he's and that's actually read in one particular document signed by him, which is, I love to say, to read it, which is as on December 16, 1398, 3 florins, 26 soldi and 8 denari, so that's the current of the day, shall be given to Piero di Riccio for 6 barrels of Chianti wine. The aforementioned will be paid by a written letter to La Fomazzei. So this man was doing exactly what we're doing today, but in the 14th century.
Wow.
And thanks for him, we arrived then in Chianti, because his granddaughter married the landlord of Fonterutoli. And then after 25 generations, it's been handled, and we're very lucky to have this unique paradise in the middle of Tuscany.
And it is paradise, right?
Yes, one of my favorites, and your favorite regions. We absolutely love it.
So
love
give us
it.
A
the
sense
most
of it.
Entertaining paradise.
Yeah.
For our listeners, give us a sense of it.
Well, it's a library. Chianti Classico is like to dive in such a diversity within the same DNA. So you just really need to embrace it. Once you're here, you just need to embrace it and dive and go around the different places of or the different districts of the Chianti and discover the different terroirs, which is each producer has such a strong identity and character and way of envisioning the wine. But with everyone, we're really linked all together. We all have a strong DNA together, but with different, well, like a lot of different spikes. And I really like to say this is like the most entertaining appellations. Obviously, it's easy for me because I grew up here, but it actually is. It's one of the most entertaining appellations that I know. And that's what I like about wine. It's constantly entertainment.
We've been to different AVAs throughout Chianti Classico and various areas in the surrounding area. So one of the things that was interesting to me, we recently conducted a tasting online, and we tasted some bottles. And one of the things that I learned in a trip there last year and continuing is that there's a classification called Gran Selezione that Chianti Classico is doing. What is that for our listeners who may not know that term?
Well, that is the new category that's being created. New in a sense on formally it's a new category, but practically there were already existing those wines of that type of profile and that type of viticulture and vinification process. But finally, the government, after long processes, the government has approved it as one of the categories of the DOCG of Chianti Classico, which sits on top of the pyramid. I think it's very interesting also to understand the quality behind that and the restriction, how difficult it is to get to that particular tier. In fact, only 5% of the total production of Chianti Classico today is classified as a Gran Selezione. So it's really really high up there, and we're all working hard to get our crew classified as a Gran Cru. And I think this was really important, to a really important addition. Even if I believe that at the end of the day, rules are not really making the appellations, but was needed through the to consumers to understand that the Chianti is not just, and it's not just a wine, a normal wine. There's something very special about it.
Well, I think it's a great addition to the Chianti Classico DOCG portfolio of wine, should we say, because there are a lot of people that love Chianti Classico and a lot of people that obviously love Chianti as well. And those are two different wines, by the way, for our listeners who aren't aware of that. But Gran Selezione was really kind of, if I remember correctly, was created to launch the region of Chianti Classico into the tier of the great wines of the world. So
like
it's
crew
wine. So it's the best wine that the estate makes. It's from estate fruit, and a lot of grapes change hands in Chianti Classico during the course of the growing season and during the course of the harvest. But this must be estate grown fruit by the estate that makes the wine.
Well,
that's one.
Well,
significant
I was going to ask Giovanni,
yeah.
What are the requirements of a wine to be designated Gran Selezione?
Well,
grapes.
The requirements are But the first requirement is you need to be a state producer. So it needs to be wine that grows in your estate. So that's with the sense of a crew, exactly. And there are really strict indications in the viticulture you need to persuade. And vinification, so you can, you're free to do what you want, but the aging needs to be done in oak. And that's the first time that there's requirements of oak treatment written down, and a minimum 30 months aging. And then there's organoleptic and chemical elements that are then left to the committee to decide if the wine is allowed to be called Grand Selezione or not. There's a committee that gets together regularly, a very strict committee, that change around with different winemakers and producers and across the whole region.
Well, I also want to point out that the grape must be Sangiovese, and it's like 90% or more Sangiovese.
Well, that's well done. Yeah, of course. I forgot that because it's quite obvious.
Not for everybody else.
Sangiovese, let's cream it. It's a super Sangiovese.
Right.
Well,
obviously you can blend it with other red varieties, but the majority is Sangiovese.
Yeah, but I think it's over 90% or 92%. So it's a very small percentage of another red variety, but it's predominantly Sangiovese.
But interestingly, many producers are making their Gran Selezione red wines from 100% Sangiovese because it really is Tuscany's grape. And, you know, Giovanni, I want to talk to you about that a little bit too, because Tuscany's grape is really Sangiovese, and the region's wines reflect this in every region of Tuscany that grapes grow in. Why do you think Sangiovese, in all its incarnations throughout the province of Tuscany, does so well? I mean, it's perfect for that terroir. Why do you think that is?
Well, Sangiovese is, for me, among the other two varieties, there are Nebbiolo and Pinot Noir are the best varieties in the world. Why I say that? Because I think those are the most terroir-driven varieties that I know. Obviously, all the other varieties have sense of terroir, but I think what you get from the Pinot Noir, from the Nebbiolo, and from Sangiovese is something extraordinary. Saying that the Sangiovese is the variety of Tuscany is correct. I think that's the most important variety and where we all feel represented and recognized, but I have to say it doesn't grow the same across the whole region. I wouldn't plant much Sangiovese along the sea, but I will definitely plant Sangiovese, as we've seen it on Brunello, in Chianti Classico, in Carmignano, in other regions. And that's where you have the most outstanding Sangiovese. And this sense of terroir, the sense of territory, and the sense of, with great sense of identity, which what we like. I mean, me as a consumer, that's what I love. I love to drink a glass of wine full of energy, tense, electrifying, as the Sangiovese, with this really dynamic tannins, and then a lot of aromatics and flavors, violet, lavender, and orange peel, cherries, and explosion in your mouth, but very vertical. That's what we like and what we feel represented by the Sangiovese, this really vertical type of wine.
You know, it's interesting because we've been to Maremma. We were in Maremma last year, and you have Belguardo in Maremma. How is that estate different from Fontruitoli?
Well, Belguardo, you got such a sense of freedom when you're there, especially for us coming from Castello di Fontruitoli, where we have a pyramid production based on the Sangiovese and a different selection, different crew. Where instead in Belguardo we had the potential to express ourselves in a more free way, and we planted in Cabernet Franc, Cabernet Sauvignon, and we have some Malvasia, some Petit Verdot, and Lucy Laura international varieties, among also with some Sangiovese where we make Tavo Morellino, and I think it's one of the greatest regions for white wines, and one in particular is the Vermentino, which is the variety of the Mediterranean. And we make also a great rosé, which is a blend of Sangiovese and Syrah.
Well, we really love the Vermentinos. When we were there, they really did stand out quite a bit.
Yeah, I think we were actually there with Francesco Mazze last fall.
Yeah.
In October, yeah. And spent about, I think, a week traveling around the Maremma with him, and it was just a fabulous trip. And he was so open with what his vision for Maremma was and what was going on there. It was really great to spend some time with him.
Remind us, what's your relationship with Francesco?
Mine is my uncle.
Okay, he's your uncle. That's what, I just want to clarify that.
So one of the things that surprised me most, Melanie, also was the fact that the white wine production in the Maremma, it's just top notch.
It's really amazing.
Yeah, fascinating.
Now, we also keep going.
I think it's really, as you said, it's really top notch, and I think the Vermentino is getting. Is really its place in the, among the best white wines of the world, and in particular the one in Maremma, because you have the character and the sappiness, the level of citrics that you get, as well as a similar, like as well as the islands of Corsica and Sardinia, but with much more finesse, in my opinion. And I think it's where we are in Belguado, is located underneath it of Montagnata and looking at the Argentario, you have the perfect climb to grow outstanding Vermentino with that nice aromatics and at the same time power and structure.
Yeah, it's a beautiful one. I also like the rosés that when we were there. They're really quite lovely. You also make a super Tuscan, Sieppe, which is 50% Sangiovese and 50% Merlot. Tell us about your approach to making super Tuscans.
Well, Sieppe is the wine that represents the revolution that we've done in our way of we envision our viticulture. So that was really, it really means a lot for us, Sieppe, because Sieppe was the first wine the second wine after Concerto, but the first real wine that has shown the willing of changing the viticulture of Tuscany. And in the 70s, we decided that it was time to replant some of the vineyards at Sieppe. And my grandfather insisted to introduce something new. And with my uncles and my father, they decided to introduce the Merlot, because after the analysis that we've done to the soil and taking all the considerations of the locations, and also looking at what the Merlot was really growing in Tuscany and what were the results, we were really encouraged. And so after over 15 years, we decided that there was the time to release the first labels of Sieppe, the first vintage. But there was a lot of fight in the family because we wanted to go, I was too young, but my father and my uncles, so the younger generation, wanted to go for 100% Merlot, while my grandfather wanted to keep it as much as possible territorial. So then they came out with a decision, which I think no better decision could have been made, to go for a blend of 50 Sangiovese and 50 Merlot. And that makes it unique immediately, because you needed the two varieties are predominant. You have the elegance, the silkiness, the electricity, the really electrifying Sangiovese, with the roundness and the chocolate, the black fruit of the Merlot combined together. And that makes it, I think, a really unique, and also unique by the fact that the 50-50 Sangiovese Merlot, where the two varieties are really complementary, there are not much expressions across Tuscany. You have one in the Chianti Classico, which is Sieppe, and one in Montalcino, which is Luce. And then you can consider as well 50-50 Avignonese Campanelle, but 50 comes from outside the Chianti Classico. So there's a really unique expression, a really unique type of wine, and coming from one of the oldest vineyards of Tuscany. Because I don't know if you know, but we discovered when we were celebrating the 20th anniversary, after long discussions at the table in my family, that we always knew the Sieppe was planted as a vineyard already in the 1500. But we never found the document. And then suddenly my father decided enough is enough, and he went through the whole family archive. And we found the first document that we have Sieppe as a vineyard is dated 1461.
Wow.
Which is, for me, extraordinary. I mean, we haven't discovered anything. That's the thing. I mean,
Well, you know, and that's what's interesting about that's what's interesting about Italian wines in general, especially Tuscany and the central Italian region, north of Rome and through Tuscany up to Florence, is that the Bordeaux varietals, as we like to call them, Cabernet Franc, Cabernet and Merlot, have been planted there for hundreds of years and are really a part of the fabric of those wines as well.
But traditions run very tight and strong. So we love the discussion of the struggle to get the family to agree and the kind of the King David split, 50 Merlot, 50 Sangiovese. Now, we want to make sure we have a little less than a minute, Giovanni. But first of all, we want to thank you for joining us from Tuscany. We want to go back to Italy. When are we going to go able to travel again?
As soon as possible, I hope.
As do we.
But in the meantime, your wines are widely available in the United States. Taub Family Wines is the importer. And so that is lucky for us that you can find them. And you can also on the website, the main website is www.mazzei.it. So very important. So you're primed to lead the family into the next generation. Do you have any parting thoughts about that before we close?
Well, yeah. Well, I'm just the housekeeper here, and I already have two kids, and I hope that we're going to handle it to them when they're going to be ready. But that's no one of the generation is the owner. That's the way that we carry on for so many years. No one of us is never the owner of what we get handled.
You're custodians of the land.
That's true. You're just the stewards of the land.
Of the land.
And of company.
Well, exactly. A toast to you for and your family for being the stewards of the land and producing such incredibly beautiful wines.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Giovanni.
And I hope to see you soon.
As do we.
And
raise a glass with you in person.
So we have come to the conclusion of our show. We hope everyone has enjoyed it. Just a reminder, you can hear all our shows on about 35 podcast platforms permanently, anytime, anywhere. We suggest going to iHeart or Spotify or Pandora, but it's your choice. And stay tuned for another edition of The Connected Table next Wednesday. Until then, stay insatiably curious.